for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. is taking a bold step to preserve fisheries. For the first time ever, there'll be catch limits on all 526 species of fish managed by the federal government. The program's been widely praised, but there are some who question if it strikes the right balance between environmental and economic concerns. Joining me to talk about preserving U.S. fisheries, Juliet Eilprin of The Washington Post, Eric Schwab of NOAA, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and John Connolly of the National Fisheries Institute. Of course, you are always welcome to be part of the program. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Eric Schwab, if I could start with you. There have been catch quotas before, but this seems to be far broader with far more reach. Give us an overview.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
So as you said, the story is the completion of catch limits to put in place for all federally managed fisheries. The benefit of this is, of course, that it sets the stage to end overfishing, to rebuild depleted stocks, and to ensure sustainable management of fisheries in federal waters for the foreseeable future. This is obviously important to us currently, both economically and environmentally, but it's also important that we manage these fisheries sustainably to ensure these same benefits for future generations.
Is there to be a scientific allocation of what is caught?
So one of the other underlying issues, of course, is both in the reauthorization of this law, the Congress mandated that the fishery management councils who make these decisions regionally follow the best available science. There is an incredibly wealthy knowledge behind many of these management decisions and just great fishery science that happens both within the agency and with partner agencies and organizations. But obviously maintaining the best science over the long term to inform the most effective catch limits continues to be a challenge going forward.
Okay, so you're using the best science, but how do you determine what level marks sustainability in each of these 526 species?
So these are levels that basically the stocks of fish can sustain on a continuing basis. In some respects, this is akin to a bank account. So if you have depleted stocks, they can produce on a sustainable basis fewer fish. If you rebuild the stocks, you rebuild the account, you can produce more fish over time on a sustainable basis. Now, the ocean is complicated, the environment is complicated, so it's not as simple as that. And understanding both the current level of those stocks as well as their long-term productive capacity is a continuing challenge.
So what then does the government do when a certain species falls below that, quote, sustainable level?
So that's the crux of this mandate, which is to first set catch limits based on the best available science. And those are set not only by government scientists, but with participation from scientists at the state level, from academic institutions and work of fishery management councils around the country. But then there is also a provision that puts in place accountability measures. So if we fall below if we exceed those catch limits, then measures kick in that ratchet back fishing activity, either commercially or recreationally or in some cases both.
And final question, how many inspectors do you have out there to validate what fishermen say or you know, there are so many fisheries in this country. How in the world do you count and make sure you have an accurate count?
So there are a number of different facets to that. We do what we call fishery independent surveys. We spent last year in 80 different surveys over 3,000 days at sea, directly surveying the status of populations. At the same time, with commercial fishermen, we have observers who spend time actually at sea on the boats. And that's a fairly common part of the commercial management approach, where there are independent observers on boats.
Sounds to me as though you're going to have an awful lot of government employees on boats.
Well, the observers are in some cases government employees. In some cases, the requirement of the fishery imposes on the commercial industry itself independent contractors who provide that same service.
Eric Schwab of NOAA. Turning to you, John Connolly, president of the National Fisheries Institute, do you agree with these preservation efforts?
Of course, Diane, no one cares more about the sustainability of a fish stock than those that make their livelihood from fishing. So there was a significant debate 5 years ago in the Magnuson-Stevens Act reauthorization, and that's the law that governs our fisheries in this country. The call for overfishing was decided by Congress, and Eric and his team at NOAA Fisheries have done what the government has asked or Congress has asked and implemented or begun rules that will stop overfishing. And the key for the fishing industry and the fishing communities are or is that the work must be done on a sound science basis, that the so we call strongly for additional funding for NOAA to make sure that the science is done well, is done accurately, and is done regularly. Because without sound science or good data upon which to make decisions, then there'll constantly be arguments and potentially litigation in the future, which is unfortunate.
Do you believe there is going to be additional or sufficient funding to carry this out?
Well, listening to your programs in other days, Diane, there's a debate about funding in the government. But for the seafood community, what's essential is that NOAA have enough funding to do the kind of surveys that allow NOAA Fisheries to understand how much fish is out there, how much fish is caught, how much can be caught in the future, to find that point at which we want to provide enough food for a healthy diet for Americans, but also keep enough fish for the future.
Just for my sake and for our listeners' sake, give us an idea of just how big the commercial fisheries industry actually is.
Sure. Maybe by anecdote it might be easier. If anyone's gotten a beautiful fish sandwich or a fish stick or enjoyed something at a restaurant, they've probably eaten pollock, and that's an Alaska fishery. It's a white fish, very mild tasting, but you can do a lot with it. That's about 100 million metric tons per year that comes out. That sounds like a lot, and that is a lot of fish. However, that's generally recognized as the finest run fishery in the world. And it's because there's a collaborative effort between government, industry, conservation groups, and academics to determine what's the appropriate number of fish to be caught. And then, as Eric said, to have observers on board ships and vessels to make sure that that number isn't exceeded. And if not specific, if not in person, then to have vessel monitoring systems, which are more electronic means to determine how much fish is caught.
Eric Schwab, John Connolly, he's president of the National Fisheries Institute. Juliet Alperin, how did all this come together? It seems that there are an awful lot of working parts to make this kind of agreement come into force.
What's interesting about this agreement, in contrast to many other environmental issues, is it really was the product of a bipartisan effort to change the way fisheries are run in America. And there's both considerable bipartisan support for it and also some bipartisan opposition at this point. But when you go back 5 years ago, which is when really all of this came into being, when there was a reauthorization of the national fisheries law, what happened is you actually had a Republican president, George W. Bush, who certainly did not make many friends in the environmental movement, who teamed up with lawmakers on Capitol Hill, including the late Senator Ted Stevens, who was one of the original authors of this law back several decades ago, and Daniel Inouye, a Democrat of Hawaii. And they made it clear that any agreement that passed the Senate had to have the backing of both Democrats and Republicans. And so what you really saw was just this collaboration between a Republican administration, which was, frankly, much more comfortable working on fisheries issues with environmental groups than, say, other issues that it dealt with, whether you're talking forestry or greenhouse gas emissions, things like that. And so they came to this idea that while they might have to compromise on certain things, they really wanted to put in this scientific requirement to end overfishing. And that's the real distinction that we've seen. And it's managed to endure in part because it really did have a bipartisan coalition behind it from the beginning that has sustained to this
day. And in addition to that bipartisan coalition, you've got regional forces.
Right. So one thing that's really interesting about fisheries is that you find that, you know, obviously there's the old saying that all politics is local. That's never more true than when you're talking about fisheries. So the politics in New England is very different from, for example, when John talks about Alaska, where you've had some of the best run fisheries for decades, and there's absolute bipartisan agreement on, for example, adhering to the science. Or again, the Southeast Atlantic is a place where there's contentiousness. So you're able to forge alliances depending on the region of the country you're talking about, which does change the political equation.
Juliet Heilprin, she is environmental reporter for The Washington Post. She's also author of the book Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more. Take your calls. Stay with us. And as we talk about the U.S. imposing new catch limits on both commercial and recreational fishing, we're joined now by Vito Giacalone. He's chairman of governmental affairs for the Northeast Seafood Coalition. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Vito, I gather you have some serious concerns about this plan. Tell me about them.
Well, I think the biggest issue is that for years we've been hearing this is not a one-size-fits-all application that would work. And, you know, for years we've heard sort of the feeling or the insinuation that in New England politics and the regional council process has somehow consistently allowed overfishing to occur or allowed catch limits. Catch limits are not new. Hearing in the show that there's a discussion for the first time we're going to have catch limits. Well, we've had, for as long as I've been at this, we've had catch limits. And in 2004, our fishery went to a even more accountable management regime that was basically looking to honor the 1996 Sustainable Fisheries Act, which was a reauthorization of Magnuson that mandated rebuilding fish stocks basically arbitrary time frames. So although we agree completely with the ending overfishing and that we should be fishing at sustainable levels, and as John correctly points out, no stakeholders more so than the commercial fishing industry are extremely concerned and have a stake in the game when it comes to ending overfishing, because by rebuilding fish stocks, that's a great thing for commercial fishermen that rely on the resource. The issue is that rebuilding basically has Congress mandating Mother Nature perform at a certain level, and that so the annual catch limits are not just set to fish at sustainable levels. The annual catch limits are set through an additional mandate, which is to, for lack of a better word, pretend that we can force a fish stock to perform in the ecosystem at a certain level on a certain rebuilding timeline and trajectory. And that's what's proven to pretty much fail most of the fisheries, is that if the fish stocks don't perform the way the science believed they could in projecting out into the future, then what you do is you ratchet fishing down way below what would be considered a sustainable level, even under the scientific knowledge, and you bring it down to some artificially low rebuilding level. And there's where the kicker basically is causing all of these serious nosebleed management responses happening.
So I gather, Vito, you're particularly concerned about the rebuilding time frames.
Well, the rebuilding, I'll just put out there, the biggest concern is that this entire theoretical approach to fisheries management assumes and it relies upon a foundation of scientific precision that does not exist. Well, as Eric correctly points out, we have fabulous science here, but the science is really not, and it's been proven, this is objective and not an opinion. If you look at our fisheries since 2004, we manage 12 species, 19 fish stocks, and we have not exceeded a management total allowable catch. We've had a total allowable catch, or as akin to these ACLs or annual catch limits. We've implemented those on every fish stock in our fishery since 2004, and the fishery fishing under an effort control system did not exceed any of those allowable catch limits. In fact, in many cases, less than 50% of the amount was caught. Yet, in retrospect, the system that we've set up is that we then look at the fish stocks again 2 or 3 years down the road and say, although we set an annual catch limit, for example, of 10, and the fishery only caught 6, in retrospect, it looks like we were wrong scientifically, and the healthy level or to the rebuilding level should have been 3. So we end up in this constant state of looking back and saying we continue to overfish, even when the fishery has not exceeded an annual catch limit.
Okay, so Vito,
it's a serious problem. We're not gonna get out of the quagmire of sustainable fisheries, and a fishery,
okay,
by definition,
but
the recreational and commercial aspects as well.
All right, but let me ask you then, what sort of program you would have preferred rather than these new catch limits?
We're going to say, when we look at this, an extraordinarily high allowable catch limit is produced or recommended by the science just as often as a too low annual catch limit. So what I'm getting at is that the scientific precision for moving forward, and especially in our fishery, which we don't have the luxury of hundred thousands of metric tons, we have very small ACLs or annual catch limits that we work with, is that rather than have the very huge highs that we believe are too high for some fish stocks and could potentially jeopardize, this law does not protect a fish stock when we move away from effort controls and into purely output control management, does not protect the fish stock from overfishing. Because if the ACL that's set by the science is too high and the fishery catches all of it or even something less than that, and then retrospectively find out we continue to overfish, we can potentially jeopardize these stocks.
All right, let's get Eric Schwab's, let's get Eric Schwab's response to your points.
Terrific.
Well, thanks, Diane, and good morning, Vito.
Good morning, Eric.
Good to hear from you. So Vito covered a lot of ground there.
He sure did.
I think that certainly we agree that the science is not as always as precise as it as we would all like it to be. It is accurate, certainly much more often than not. And the question then becomes, even when science is accurate at any given point in time and we have certain expectations, Mother Nature does not always cooperate. You know, these ocean ecosystems, you know, have been challenged by a lot of other things beyond fishing over the years. And how do we react when the expectations of fishermen, when the expectations of scientists and managers don't come to be in future years? And I think that's one of the most important things that we need to do is, number one, maintain that science focus so that we can make the appropriate adjustments. Vito's right that we need to make work very closely with fishermen and fishing communities to provide the maximum business opportunity that any given fish stock can produce. He talked a little bit about output controls, and we have been working on a management system up in with the New England groundfish fishery that is called sector management. It gives fishermen more freedom to work with a focus on staying within catch limits. And he did indicate, and he's right, that they've done a very good job of staying within those catch limits. And there's probably more that I can say, but most importantly, we need to continue to work together. We need to bring the science, we need to bring the management, and we need to bring the experiences and the needs of fishermen together in one place to make decisions.
Juliet, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I think part of what you're hearing is from Vito is the idea that there's tremendous pressure on wild fisheries across the nation and, frankly, across the world. And we're in a situation right now where you've had intense fishing for centuries, like we've had up in New England and elsewhere in the world, that it's more challenging to manage these fisheries because they've been decimated over time. And while there have been genuine efforts to bring them back, sometimes this is not predictable. And that also, you know, we're dealing with the fact that we're trying to balance trying to get wild fish that we can sell, as well as raising some, importing a huge amount of seafood, which we do to the United States. And so really, we are in a difficult situation, which is why some of these tough choices are being made now.
John Connolly.
Just to follow on briefly, it's important for your listeners to understand that stocks fluctuate significantly. The pollock stock that I mentioned before has had an allowable catch of 1.3 million metric tons. Within a few years, it went down to 815,000, and now it's back at 1.1 million.
So, how do you account for that?
It's Mother Nature. It's stocks go up, stocks go down. But it's important to understand that. And I think what Vito's calling for is for NOAA to recognize the fluctuations in stocks and to appreciate that that we really can't manage Mother Nature. We can try to learn as much as possible. But I think Vito's calling for a little bit of flexibility within the council system and with the NOAA fisheries team.
Vito Giacalone, last word, please.
I agree with all accounts there. I think that what we need to do is to recognize, you know, that the law demands at face value far more precision than is deliverable when we're looking forward, and that rather than try to dictate Mother Nature, let's continue to manage fisheries now that the commercial fisheries in the U.S., especially in New England, is now also able to show that the management tools we have, we can stay within the annual catch limits comfortably. What we now need to do is stabilize those annual catch limits. And what we're saying is we should forego the ability to have very high annual catch limits on a short-term recommendation in return for not having those nosebleed situations where we're now being told you have to reduce fishing to zero even after you've stayed within the catch limits.
All right.
And, you know, that's the common sense. We want to sustain fishing communities and commercial fisheries while fishing at levels, and definitely the science is capable of looking back and setting that sweet spot, we'll call it, where we know that the level of fishing has proven over time, over decades, that its fish stock has never declined, is always in an upward trend. Is if we were to set our ACLs at that level, that's going to knock a lot off the top, but it's also going to eliminate the situations like this crisis that we have coming up in Gulf of Maine cod, where, you know, it seems to be basically just a technical result of us pretending that we know how to forecast an annual catch limit out in front of us.
All right. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Vito Giacalone. He's chairman of for Governmental Affairs at the Northeast Seafood Coalition. And joining us now from New Gretna, New Jersey, is Jim Donofrio of the Recreational Fishing Alliance. Good morning to you, Jim.
Good morning, Diane, and thank you.
Give me an idea of how recreational fishermen and women in your organization are looking at this new plan and thinking about it.
Well, we have big concerns because we feel that right now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the data collection system for recreational fishing has been deemed by the National Research Council as fatally flawed and it should not be used for annual monitoring. Now, NOAA has a federal mandate from Congress to put in a new program, which they're 2 years behind already. And Eric will tell you that, as he just announced, it may not be even in effect till late 2012 or 2013. So how can we then be held accountable with these rigid annual catch limits and accountability measures when we don't have a catch system that's accountable? I mean, this is incredible that the agency doesn't have the integrity to suspend the ACLs and the accountability measures until they have a program in place.
Give me a sense from your perspective, Jim, of how the size of the recreational fishing industry compares to the commercial.
Well, we're a large industry. Some of the figures are as high as I've heard $60 billion, but I think that incorporates freshwater. But it's huge. It's a huge industry. I know the NOAA estimates are 10 million saltwater anglers, but I don't believe it's 10 million because anyone that goes to saltwater once a year is probably accounted in that. The number's probably lower than that. I'd say the hardcore numbers, people that really fish for a passion, the numbers are probably maybe half that. But if there's 5 million anglers, that are hardcore, that's great. That's a lot of people, but it means a lot of business. There's a lot of shoreside tackle, marinas, service people, boat building, boat service, all that comes into effect. It's a huge industry, and then, of course, it trickles down to the restaurants, hotels, et cetera.
Sure. Eric Schwab, are there separate quotas then for recreational and commercial fishing?
Yeah, we have the way the councils are managed. They have, especially like in joint fisheries such as summer flounder and sea bass. The commercial sector has their quota that they fish on, and the recreational sector has theirs. But we're managed by seasons, size limits, and bag limits. So we already have an accountability measure in place right there. We're accountable to that, and we make adjustments the next year, and they'll say, okay, we may have to cut you back in time, or we'll cut you back in size. Or limit, but to have all this other in place is kind of like double jeopardy. We're already managed.
All right, I want to get Eric Schwab's comment.
So there would be for stocks where there are both recreational and commercial interests, there is a total allowable catch that is set, and that total allowable catch is then divided among commercial fishermen and the recreational community. The recreational community being larger in number and more dispersed is generally their fishing catch is assessed based on a survey process, and that's the process that Jim spoke to. That survey process involves a certain number of telephone surveys, a certain number of surveys of fishermen returning to the dock, and then that's put together to estimate recreational catch. In some cases, recreational catch can be every bit as important to the long-term management objectives as the commercial catch, in some cases more.
And Juliet, does that seem to be measured out fairly?
Well, I think most people, including probably Eric Schwab, would admit that right now there's not the data that NOAA would want to fairly figure out at this point exactly how much is being caught. It's so much harder. You don't have an observer. I mean, we don't have that many federal observers to begin with, honestly. But you certainly, when you decide to go out shark fishing or, you know, going for, you know, marlin or something like that, you don't usually have someone on your, by your side who's checking and seeing how much you're doing or going for red snapper. So right now there has been basically they're reevaluating their process, but it isn't fully implemented. And again, to some extent, you're depending on self-reporting. But then the question becomes, when you don't have enough information, do you take a precautionary principle and do you cut back in how much you give people? Or do you say you can fish more right now because we're not exactly sure where the species is at?
Juliet Eilprint, she is environmental reporter for The Washington Post. Jim Donofrio, I want to thank you for joining us. He's with the Recreational Fishing Alliance. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by EBSCO, supporting libraries with electronic resource discovery and management solutions, journal subscriptions, and EBSCO host databases. By Cabot Creamery Cooperative, 5 generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. And by Constant Contact, offering email marketing and social media resources for marketing small businesses. Learn more at constantcontact.com. This is NPR.
Social networks connect people around the world, but they do pose risks. Protecting privacy in the digital age. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. A number of our listeners would like to know which fish in particular are being overfished. Juliet.
There are a number of overfish stocks, nearly 50 across the country, but some that come to mind are, for example, bluefin tuna that people might love, which is in the Gulf of Mexico, and we're still assessing how it was affected by the oil spill there, as well as it's just historically been overfished for sashimi and things like that. There are a number of shark species, which people don't think that, they might not eat it that much, but poor beagle shark, which goes for fish and chips in England, as well as sometimes is consumed here. deer or sandbar shark and dusky shark have really been overfished. White marlin is an incredible game fish that people love, and people talk about whether it should be an endangered species. So there really are a number that are in big trouble, as well as something like red snapper is doing very well in one region. It's really rebounded in the Gulf of Mexico, but is still struggling in the Southeast Atlantic.
Interesting. John Connolly.
Diane, it's important to know that 90% of what American consumers eat are in 10 species of fish, things like salmon, tuna, shrimp, pollock, tilapia, crab, scallop, etc. So for listeners concerned, the majority of what they eat are actually in pretty good shape because much of it is the kind of farmed product and wild product that Juliet talked about. There's a mix of that, for instance, for shrimp. Or for
salmon,
for instance. So most of what Americans eat is actually in pretty good shape, whether it be farmed product or under a management regime within NOAA. Things like bluefin tuna, absolutely there are challenges with bluefin tuna, particularly in out of the Mediterranean. But it's also important to know that on average, an American eats less than the weight of a paperclip worth of bluefin tuna per year. Now, there are some big bluefin tuna eaters out there in the sushi market, but on average, we eat less than the weight of a paperclip worth of bluefin tuna each year.
All right, let's open the phones going to Columbia, Missouri. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning.
Go right ahead, sir.
My question briefly, these regulations that we're putting on domestic fisheries are minuscule compared to the gross overfishing performed in by China, particularly, but other Asian countries. Is there a direction that we're thinking about moving as far as regulating, or are we going to say we're just going to regulate our own fisheries, and hopefully that will offset the continual overfishing by other countries?
Juliet.
Well, one of the issues there, and your caller is absolutely correct, that there certainly is overfishing by a number of countries, and there's demand. There's actually, for example, there are tons of European countries that do overfishing to supply, for example, the Japanese market or you know, sometimes other Asian markets. But really, what you have to look at is every country has exclusive control over 200 miles from shore in our waters. So what the U.S. has control of is that area. And so that's what's under these catch limit requirements that we're talking about. And then, of course, and Eric can speak to that, the administration is engaged in international negotiations, as previous negotiations have been, previous administrations, trying to set more stricter limits overseas as part of particularly migratory species that might spend some time in our waters, but, of course, are traveling across the Atlantic and the Pacific to other nations.
So, in fact, that's right. We are involved, in addition to domestic management, with what we call regional fishery management organizations all around the world, where we work together with other countries to manage shared stocks. And we've seen
how cooperative are they likely to be?
Well, so there is a shared interest in ensuring sustainability. The challenges are, first, obtaining the right science. Secondly, putting in place the kinds of management measures like catch limits that are really required to achieve the end objective. And then ensuring compliance. And those things can happen within those organizations. There are also worldwide or shared efforts to end pirate or illegal fishing that is outside of even these regional fishery management organizations.
Let me read this email from Liz. She says, I lived in Dakar, Senegal, from 2005 to 2006. And the local fishermen spoke often of fish they could no longer find because the international trawlers outside the national limits were taking them all before the fish came in closer to shore. Much of the fish available in Europe comes from these African shores. I'm glad the U.S. will limit levels here, but the important thing is that there be an international and enforceable limit. If not, our fish will just come from further away, and Africans, South Americans, Asians will grow hungrier.
Diane, what we're seeing on the international level is actually the experience of the U.S. in the last couple of decades. The debate, as Eric talked about and Juliet talked about, is about the science within those regional fishery management groups, with the intergovernmental groups, where we try to cooperate with Asian, Latin American, and European countries to set the appropriate levels. Juliet talked about highly migratory species, which are fish that basically circle the globe in many cases. Canned tuna is a highly migratory species. And one of the interesting programs that's developed there is, because of the frustration that the industry and conservation community felt within some of the RFMOs dealing with tuna, they actually got together. So the canned tuna industry on a global basis is now working with WWF, the leading conservation group, folks like National Geographic and others, to do science, what the appropriate science levels are, what the appropriate catch levels are, and is actually using the power of the marketplace to try to change the decisions of some of the governments involved in those intergovernmental groups.
All right. To Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good morning, Jonah.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
And thank you for also choosing subjects on your show, which are important. I was a commercial fisherman for 5 years in Alaska for many different species. One of the things that I feel like is not being addressed is bycatch. That would be catch that would come aboard, usually dead, that was not allowable because of catch limits to be sold or consumed, and therefore dumped overboard and not counted. So there's thousands and thousands, millions of pounds of food that's harvested and then dumped back into the ocean. And as a fisherman, it was always awful to see such death and mismanagement of species that weren't counted because they weren't the targeted species.
Eric.
So that's absolutely right. And I think one of the major accomplishments of recent years that I actually hear fishermen speak to with great pride is that some of these catch limits and some of these accountability measures and some of these new management systems that have been put in place more fully account for and utilize bycatch. And so if you can effectively reduce bycatch, which we are, and more effectively account for it in the science, then you will accelerate the rebuilding schedules for a lot of these stocks. You will ensure more sustainable fisheries going into the future.
And joining us now by phone is Congressman Frank Pallone. He's Democrat from New Jersey. Good morning to you, sir.
Hi, Diane. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you. I certainly can. You are, I gather, proposing some changes to this plan. Tell us what they are and your rationale.
Well, I have what I call a Magnuson flexibility bill, and basically it's designed to provide some flexibility with regard to different stocks. But with regard to the annual catch limits, the biggest concern is the fact that much of the decision making is not scientifically and rationally based. You know, I represent both commercial and recreational fishermen. I've been involved in fishing, fisheries management most of my life, and the biggest complaint I get from particularly from the recreational fishermen in my district, is that, you know, when they establish catch limits, that the science is very poor and not accurate. So it's very difficult to justify, decisions that are being made by regional fisheries councils or by National Marine Fisheries Service in Washington to your constituents without accurate science. And that's the main thing that we've been trying to do, is trying to move the science forward, make sure the decisions are rationally based, and the bill would provide a certain amount of flexibility to either suspend catch limits or otherwise deal with them if the science and the rationale is not there.
But are you saying that as currently constituted, that NOAA simply does not have sufficient science in place to do what's needed?
Absolutely, Diane. I don't think there's any question about that. In fact, when Eric Schwab, who was the director of NIMS, I don't know if he's on now or
yes,
on,
he is.
Yeah.
He's right here in the studio.
when Eric testified before the Natural Resources Committee, which, you know, I'm a member of and which has jurisdiction over fisheries, you know, this was a few months ago or so, he specifically stated that the new system we called MRIP, or the Marine Recreational Information Program, that was supposed to be put in place by 2009 was not in place and wouldn't be in place until 2012. So, you know, I think that's an example of why they simply haven't kept up. And it's very difficult as a politician, you know, and makes sense that, you know, if the science isn't there, you know, then these regimes lack legitimacy. And that's what this legislation is designed to do, to say that, you know, we have to put these systems, these better systems in place, and if they're not in place, and there's no, and the, basically what we say is that for each regional council, you know, they have a science and statistical committee, and if they can't show that the science is adequate to make these decisions about annual catch limits, then the Secretary of Commerce can come in and say that, you know, the negative impact on coastal fisheries or on the coastal economy is such that they should suspend the annual catch limits or basically go back to the drawing board if it's not scientifically based.
All right. Eric Schwab, can you comment on the congressman's point that the science simply is not there yet?
So generally, science questions are not black or white. They're matters of degrees. We acknowledge that we would love to have better science in a lot of cases.
You need more money for that.
We need lots of things to continue to improve our science. Money is a part of that. Work with fishermen, another big part of that. New technology is a third part of that. But the component of the science endeavor that Mr. Pallone spoke to and referenced my commentary in the hearing is specific to recreational catch effort, and we are putting a new program in place. So I do feel the need to clarify that there are about 230 federal stocks that make up 90% plus of the landings from federal waters, and we have today what we assess to be more than sufficient knowledge on more than half of those stocks, sound assessments on more than half of those stocks. To suggest that we don't have any science or to suggest that we completely lack science to make good sound management decisions is probably a little bit of an overstatement. Can we get better? Yes. Are we working hard to get better? Absolutely. But we need to manage these stocks responsibly, and the lack of information it does not justify taking undue risk.
Eric Schwab of NOAA, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Congressman Pallone, any other thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, Eric is basically saying the same thing that he did say before the committee. I'm not suggesting that everything that they do is lacking science, but the point I'm trying to make is that I think there has to be some flexibility, and it does make sense to, I think, to change the law to say that where the science is not adequate and they cannot justify their decisions, and there is a negative impact on, you know, the ability to fish primarily with recreational fisheries and the coastal communities, that there should be some exceptions made. And that's simply all we're saying. We're not saying that, you know, every decision that's made is inaccurate, but many are not scientifically based, and in those situations, exceptions have to be made. You know, part of, Diane, just so you understand, I mean, you know, the problem is it's an age-old problem, which is that, you know, the bureaucracy exists, and the bureaucracy, you know, carries out the law based on, you know, whatever best information they have. But when you're an elected official and you're responsible to the public, you know, they just don't find it acceptable that if things are not scientifically and rationally based, that there should be, you know, a regime or bureaucracy in place that says this is the catch limit. And, I mean, I think you can all understand that, you know, we have to be responsible to the public, too.
Of course.
And when they're saying, you know, a good percentage of these decisions are not necessarily based on the base science, then I can't go back to my constituents and say, okay, we're going to do this anyway. They say, well, that's ridiculous.
All right. Congressman Frank Pallone, Democrat from New Jersey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
We have a caller on the phone from San Antonio who says, this is having a tough effect on individual fishermen. My stepfather had to retool his business and sell his boat. Juliet, these are not easy times.
These aren't. I mean, obviously, we're facing a tough economic situation as it is. And when you do impose these requirements, it does have a cost. Now, you know, and it takes a long time to solve these problems. Some of the requirements we're seeing now came out of a collaboration in the mid-90s between Carl Safina, who heads the Blue Ocean Institute in Long Island, and Wayne Gilchrist, a former Republican member from Maryland, from this area. They started working on this, you know, ages ago. And so you are going to see that this will take time. And there are some costs to curbing the fishing that we've had for years.
Last word.
Absolutely, Diane. This is we're in a transition, unfortunately. There are going to be dislocations, which is very tough, particularly when it's a personal issue. It's easy to talk about this in the abstract, but when it's your father-in-law losing the job, that becomes very personal.
John Connolly of the National Fisheries Institute, Eric Schwab of NOAA, Juliet Eilpern of the Washington Post, a conversation that could go on for quite a while. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from